Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest today is Irina Lagunina, Associate Standards Editor and former Director and Special Projects Editor of the Russian Service here at RFERL. Welcome, Irina, and thanks very much for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting, Steve.
All right. It's great to talk to you again. Now, despite the title of this podcast, The Week Ahead in Russia, I want to ask about two things that happened late last week, but also hopefully to get into what they might portend for the future. Obviously, that's harder to say. In chronological order, the first is the prisoner swap between Russia and the United States. Now, this has obviously been big news. And there had been negotiations over the last months and couple years. But the news broke very abruptly on Thursday that Russia had freed the American basketball star Brittney Griner in exchange for the release by the United States of arms trader Victor Boot. Now, Griner, I believe she's a two-time all-star in the WNBA. She had been arrested. She'd also played in Russia for several years in the WNBA offseason. And she was arrested at a Moscow airport in February of this year, actually, about a week before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and was sentenced to 9 years in prison for possessing less than 1 gram of cannabis oil. This was in vaping cartridges that she acknowledged were in her luggage. Now, this amount, cannabis oil is illegal in Russia. She said she did not intend to break the law, and obviously the amount was quite small, leading to accusations, very widespread, that Russia was turning her into a geopolitical hostage over this infraction. Now, Boot, nicknamed the Merchant of Death for his involvement in selling weapons that had fueled conflicts on several continents, was arrested in Thailand in a U.S. sting operation in 2008 and was extradited to the United States, where he was eventually sentenced, I believe, in 2012 to 25 years in prison. Now, of course, there's been a great deal of talk about this exchange in Russia and maybe particularly in the United States. There's obviously joy over the fact that Griner is free, but it is clouded by the fact that the United States has been unable to secure the release of other Americans held in Russia. There was one other released earlier this year, Trevor Reed, but there are others who remain in prison in Russia, including Mark Fogel and Paul Whelan, who's serving a 16-year prison term on an espionage charge that he says is baseless. There are other Russians who are in prison in the United States, but for Russia and the Kremlin and President Vladimir Putin, bringing Boot back has always seemed to be a priority over the years. Irina, why is that, given his background? Why has the Kremlin been so eager to win Boot's release? And do you think other swaps may be in the cards in the relatively near future, or will Moscow essentially stop dealing, kind of stop negotiating on this now that it's gotten Boot back?
Well, Steve, it's always very difficult to predict what Moscow will do or will not do and how it will behave, because that's the nature of authoritarian state, that, it's unpredictable and everything is dependent on the voice of one person. This case, it's the voice of Mr. Putin, as we know. As for Boot, yes, Moscow really wanted his release for quite a long time and made everything possible to get this person free. You asked why? I think that the kind of the best way to answer this question is to look at Viktor Boot's biography. And this is a very interesting personage in Russian history, and actually in the present world history, because he is a product of the split of the Soviet Union. He was only 25 years old when he got into the arms, not at that time, not even arms dealership, but in some sort of dealership internationally. It was in 1992 that he bought his first three cargo planes for $120,000. He was saying in several interviews that it was at that time it was easy to get money, and that's how he started his business, and there was nothing illegal in his business. But if you look at the in the origin of where he came from, he actually came from Dushanbe. He came and started to his military career in the Military Institute of Foreign Languages. That was an institute in the Soviet Union that actually was preparing students, preparing experts for the military intelligence. Not necessarily, of course, not all the graduates went to the military intelligence, but some of them did, and that was pretty well known. So it's one of these this institutes that were pretty much, you know, high class in the Soviet Union, and it was pretty difficult to get into it. But here we have a young guy from, not even from Moscow, but from one of the Soviet republics, who came and probably due to his talent in foreign languages, he started to study there. And then all of a sudden he got a rank of a lieutenant, and he was sent to Angola and Mozambique to work as a military representative. So that actually itself shows his very close links to the Russian military. It's true that he made his first money not selling arms, but using those three cargo planes that he bought to buy gladioluses, flowers in Johannesburg, and bringing them to the Gulf states, where gladioluses were very popular at that time. But then he moved into arms dealership, and you know, the scale of his operations was so wide and so huge that it actually became, especially in Angola in late 90s, that it became actually a concern for the United Nations. The question of somebody selling arms and avoiding sanctions in such a scale actually became an international problem. In order to get this amount of all sorts of military vehicles, arms, Kalashnikovs, bullets, you know, he provided all sorts of arms and munitions to the states that were eager to get it. So the scale of it actually underlines that it was impossible to do it without a knowledge of Russian military, probably very much high-ranking Russian military guys, and without their help also. One side picture is of this is that, for example, in 95, one of his planes were seized by the Taliban and with the crew. And he, in one of the interviews, once again, he confessed that he went 7 times to Kandahar to negotiate their release. He was accompanied, or he was accompanying, it's difficult to say, the special envoy of the Russian president in Afghanistan, the diplomat by the name Zamir Kabulov. That's a very high-ranking Russian diplomat. So that shows how much value Viktor Bout had as an illegal arms dealer for the Russian high-ranking officials. That's why they wanted to get him no matter what, and they finally did, which is a surprise, actually, step, because I always thought that Russia would exchange Bout for more than one person, but apparently something didn't work. Steve?
Yeah, absolutely. And President Biden and I think other U.S. officials expressed frustration and tried to explain that, you know, it wasn't a matter of two for one or two for two. This was what we could get. So this is what happened. Brittany Griner exchanged for Viktor Bout. And I mean, that's a fascinating background of Bout. And another reason I think, so he's, you know, you're saying he's part of the, he's kind of part of the establishment, part of the security services. And I also think, you know, he's a symbol because he's a symbol of, you know, for Russia, the frustration at the fact that the U.S. Was able to, you know, have him extradited to, you know, to kind of engineer his arrest in Thailand, have him extradited. So, you know, there that was something that they obviously did not like and are, you know, portrayed as unfair. In fact, I was watching an interview with Bout on RT, which has a lot of just untruths and such, including one which the presenter or the interviewer, Maria Butina, who spent time in the U.S. Behind bars, says that Bout says straight out, essentially in the introduction, that Bout was imprisoned without investigation or trial, you know, which is obviously completely false. And there were some other falsehoods there. But that's kind of the narrative, you know, that they portray. I guess for me, a question is whether there are other figures who, you know, Russia, there are some hackers and others, Russians in prison in the U.S. or in jail. I guess the question is whether Russia's desire, the Kremlin's desire to get any of them back is strong enough to provide for future exchanges.
Well, you know, Steve, I wrote quite a lot and made several radio programs about Viktor Bout before he was arrested. But at some point I got a call from a Russian TV that was about probably 10 years ago. Bout was already in prison, and they asked me if I could participate in their program, and I asked, so why did they make this choice of, you know, calling me? And the lady confessed that they actually spoke to a lot of people but in Russia, but nobody could say a bad word about Bout. So that's why they needed me for balance. So I said no, thank you, and refused to participate and to be the only bad guy there on TV.
Yeah, that's but they always try that, I think, with to get the bad guy that they can pile on in those shows.
Yeah, but you know, we were joking that when he was released last week, we were joking that now he can actually take a place near the other notorious guy, which is Andrei Lugavoy, who was suspected to be involved in the poisoning of Alexander Litvinenko in Britain, the KGB whistleblower, who was poisoned with polonium 2010. And it turns out that it was not really a joke because today we got the news that Viktor Butt actually decided to join the LDPR, so-called Liberal Democratic Party of Russia, which is not liberal and not democratic at all. It's just a name. And Lugovoy is as well as a member of LDPR. So might be that we will see Mr. Butt very soon in Russian Duma or in some sort of power structure.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's pretty amazing. That's kind of the speculation that, essentially is, it does seem like a joke. It's like, okay, this is going to happen. And then it does happen. Right. And there's, the kind of interesting the way, and I guess Butina, is also in the Duma. But these are people whose only sort of, they're not politicians, or people's only claim to fame is that they're are essentially that they're criminals. I mean, Boot is a symbol or suspected criminals. So we'll see what happens with that. Certainly in this interview that I watched, his words, his language was fitting into kind of the mainstream Russian narratives now. He was talking about Anglo-Saxons being and the collapse of Western civilization, and things like that. So he's going to be one, from judging from that, it'll be one sort of voice among many. But we will see what happens in the future. Thanks very much. Now, the other story I want to discuss also occurred last week on Friday, also involves prison, like many things that happened in Russia under Putin, I would say. For a journalist, covering Russia often means, has meant over the past 20 years or so, covering the politically charged trials of opponents of Putin or simply people who have run afoul of the state, and waiting to hear not so much the verdict, which is really almost always guilty, a guilty verdict, as the sentence. How many years in prison, or will the sentence be suspended? So that the defendant will avoid prison, as was long the case for Navalny, but then now is no longer the case. Of course, he's now serving a long prison term on charges he says are bogus. Also Mikhail Khodorkovsky and many others. And now on Friday, Ilya Yashin, opposition politician who's been an opponent of the state, of the government, an opponent of Putin's government's, since the early days. He was one of the major leaders of the protests, the Bolotnaya protests, 11 and 10 years ago. Now, he was tried under a new law that was passed. I believe Putin signed it a few days or a week or two after the invasion that he ordered of Ukraine. The law criminalizes what the state considers the deliberate distribution of false information about the Russian military. And Yashin specifically was charged over comments on YouTube in which he discussed the alleged atrocities committed by Russian forces in Bucha, Ukraine, in the first weeks of the invasion. Now, that city outside Kiev, of course, is now almost synonymous with what survivors, activists, and Ukrainian authorities say were numerous war crimes and similar reports, allegations, horror stories have emerged from countless other towns and cities that, were at some point under Russian occupation and are now no longer as Ukrainian forces, have taken them back. And in general, Yashin has spoken out vehemently against the war. In his last court appearance before the verdict hearing, he urged Putin to withdraw Russian troops from Ukraine and end what he called the monstrous war. And he said that Putin's name is now inextricably associated with death and destruction, those two words. Prosecutors sought, which I think is, fair to say is what is what many people feel, particularly certainly in the West, I think, in Ukraine. Now, prosecutors had sought a 9-year sentence for Yashin, and the judge, I don't know if this was trolling. The judge cut 6 months off that and handed him a 8.5 year prison sentence. Irina, what do you think is behind, I guess, the prosecution and the sentence for Yashin? Is he being punished for his opposition to the war? Or perhaps, as many say, is the case with Navalny, who dared to return to Russia after surviving a poisoning that he blames on Putin, and was arrested upon return. Is Yashin being punished, more for refusing to leave Russia?
I think that the second, Steve, I think that Yashin was punished for the fact that he wanted to continue the opposition activity inside Russia. Because if you look at the statistics of these cases that are based on this article 207 of the Criminal Code of Russia about the so-called military fakes, spreading of military fakes, then there are quite a lot of cases right now. The statistics come with delay, so right now it's about 7,000, but the pure statistics of the cases, for example, by the end of October was almost 5,000 cases since the start of the military operation, and so-called since the start of the war, and since this amendment to the criminal code was signed. So, out of this 5,000 cases, almost 4,000 came to the like lower courts in Russia, and out of this, all kind of out of this, it's to be exact, it's 3,400 by the end of October. And out of them, 2,500 ended up with fines, not with prison sentences, but with fines. Yes, people were found guilty, but they were not put in prison. Actually, today there is a case that one of the activists from Krasnoyarsk, Natalia Podolyak, was found guilty for the court used the same article because of what she was commenting in the Russian social media of ВКонтакте. It's an analog of Facebook in Russia. So once again, she was fined for 30,000 rubles. The only exception, which is a very kind of vivid exception of this, when the person got a long prison sentence, 7 years, was given to the lawyer and deputy of the local municipality in Moscow, Alexei Gorinov. He once again he got 7 years. Now Yashin got 8.5 years. So this is a straight sign of the Russian authorities that if you are in opposition, if you want to be public, if you don't want to follow the party line or the Kremlin line, you will either be in prison or you have to leave the country. And I think that this is very clear, and statistics actually proves it.
Thanks. Yeah, that is quite amazing evidence pointing to that, actually. I must say I had no idea that there were so many cases of this since the law was signed, I guess in early March. But as you say, only a few with long or only two really long prison terms. And I should have mentioned, didn't mention that Yashin, like Gordonov, has been a municipal lawmaker in Moscow. So, he's somebody who was in fact, or, is in fact a politician, and has held office. So this, and I think this adds to the, the ire, I guess, of the Kremlin, of the state, and their desire to, as you say, either, force them out of Russia. And of course, many people who oppose the war and or fear mobilization, draft, have left. and the government, the Kremlin, does not seem to be, does not seem to be upset about that. It seems to be trying to kind of consolidate power among the people who, who are unwilling or unable to leave. So yeah, as you say, I think, it's kind of the stark choice that I guess Navalny was given, unofficially, and Yashin as well, of either be imprisoned or, either leave the country or be imprisoned. All right, we are getting short of time, but let's take a few questions if there are any. Happy to take a couple questions. Again, you can raise your hand by hitting the button to request to speak. You can send a DM or ask your question, post your question as a reply in this Twitter space. Okay, and if not, 3:30, we can wrap it up. Irina, thanks very much for joining me.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Steve. It's a pleasure.
All right, it's great to have you on the show again. Once again, I've been speaking to Irina Lagunina, Associate Standards Editor and former Director and Special Projects Editor of the Russian Service at RFERL. And my name is Steve Gutterman, Editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. As I mentioned, this conversation will also be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFERL podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Google, and other podcast platforms. I'll be back next Monday for another installment of The Week Ahead in Russia. And please keep an eye out for the next edition of my newsletter, The Week in Russia, on December 23rd. Thanks for listening.